beautiful. You sound like a professional. Matt Eisman,
now,
ladies and gentlemen.
Now I am.
Matt, we're live. How about that? How about them beans?
Keith, this is remarkable. I'm so glad to be on here. We're wearing each other's hats and a chance to, I got to say, I'm missing being on stage. I know a lot of the comics I'm tweeting because we can't talk in person, but it's just been the thing we miss. We miss the crowds. We miss the live performance. We miss that juice.
So what have you been doing? First of all, let me introduce you to the people. This is Matt Eisman. I've known Matt Eisman for probably nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
Would you say that?
I have the Rocky Mountain Laugh Off poster from the first time I did it. It was August 2001.
Okay.
That was when I came out to Wise Guys for the first time and met you.
That's a long time ago. And yeah. Matt, since then, he did the Rocky Mountain Laugh Off. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that's a comedy competition that I put on here in Utah. And comedians come from all over the place. They compete and hopefully do well and have a good experience. And obviously, it seems like you did have a good experience.
It was one of the most fun times. I'd done small comedy contests before, Comedy Works in Denver. Little open mic ones. But this one, I think it was 5 days. We got to perform not just all over Salt Lake, all over Utah. We were in Ogden, Provo. We did outdoor shows, indoor shows. It was an unbelievable experience as a comic because we got to do club shows. We got to do an outdoor venue, like a music venue, things I'd never done before. And I remember we were sweating bullets. It was a great group. 17 comics started out. And I stayed in touch with so many. Ryan Hamilton, who's mm-hmm. just blown up since then. Well, he was just starting out. And, of course, Michael Batts, PJ Walsh, and Courtney Cronin, some of my dearest friends were in it, Dan Smith. But it was such a good time. And one of the things, one of the reasons that I absolutely love you is because you're a comic. You started out as a comic. So as a club owner, you're someone who nurtures comics, who nurtures comedy. And I look at the way Utah, I think the reason Utah has a good comedy scene is largely due to you and the way you offer young comics opportunities and the way you push us. So I was doing that. I think I had about 15 minutes, probably four of which was solid. And that was in August. And you go, hey, I'd love to headline you. And I go, I got to be honest, Keith, I got like 14 minutes. And you go, you'll be okay. And you headlined me in Ogden that October. My parents flew out, and it was the first time I ever headlined. And you were right. Like, necessity is the mother of writing. And you find a way to fill. And it was just amazing that you took a shot at probably you saw more in comics than we saw in ourselves.
Well, you know so. What? When I first started doing comedy, and I was in L.A. when I started, so I wasn't up here. And I do remember trying to get money and trying to somehow survive it and get booked on some gigs. And that was back in the days when you'd record a big VHS tape and you'd send it in a padded envelope and hope that David Tribble or one of the bookers would respond.
Yeah.
And I was trying to become a feature act. And for those of you who don't know, that's like the opener that does maybe 30 minutes. And I probably had, you know, 10 or 15, and it was wobbly, believe me. But I got booked, and I knew that if they said, okay, we're going to book you, and you're coming out here in 2 or 3 months, I knew that I had to put the pedal to the metal and get my ducks in a row so that when I did go, I had it. And I'd use that same theory, which may not be a great theory, but with you, and with Ryan Hamilton.
Yeah.
I remember the first time, Ryan and Bent Washburn, who's also a great comic,
monster.
Those guys headlined before they were fully ready, or they were booked to headline before they were fully ready. But by the time they did headline, they're ready to go.
And I think that was one of the things with comedy. People always ask, what's the shortcut? What's the way to do it? There's no shortcut. You just do it. You get on stage, and the more stage time you get, the better you get. And it's just one of those absolute, it's an absolute constant. The more times you perform, the easier it gets, the more material you have, the better gauge of your own comedy you become. And it was such an exciting time. I mean, starting out, it's funny. They always talk about it. You always think of those glory days when you're really ham and egging it. I mean, we drove out to Utah to do this laugh off because it was an opportunity. We living in LA, stage time is so precious. And you know, if you're lucky, you're getting a 12-minute set on a weekend. And there is just nothing like when you're up there for 45 minutes and you can let it breathe and you can work it. And it is, you've created some monster venues out there with some wonderful fans. And it's always fun to go because I feel like Utah is a place where they get it. They get the jokes. They appreciate the jokes. And, you know, and I think judging by the comedians you've had coming by, they also, you know, they know you take care of the comedians. You put on a good room, which people always appreciate.
Well, you're very kind. You got it going, brother. Let me ask you this. During this whole virus thing, that's, I don't know if you've heard about it, but there's a virus. They're asking, are you staying in your house? Are you locked
in? Yeah. So for a couple reasons. I mean, all the work I'm doing is suspended. So, or, you know, is on. We were supposed to start American Ninja Warrior March 13th. We were going to start in L.A. And obviously things started cracking down. And part of it was the weather that really postponed it. And I mean, it was amazing how in just a matter of, you know, a day, it went from, hey, we're going to skip rehearsal. We'll just go into taping. And then it's like, you know what? We're going to tape without an audience. And then it went to we're locked down. And, you know, we had a couple other dates that we kept on the books, and those, everything is now just, we're just waiting. We're in the same position that a lot of production is. That requires people being together. You just can't, for safety reasons, do it. So Ninja Warrior,
have they given you any, because I speak to these LA types all the time, Matt,
yeah,
and they seem to have the answer as to when it's going to be a go for people. It's going to be safe. What are you hearing?
Yeah, you know, President Trump called us up and he told us we just sworn to secrecy. No, we don't have a clue. Listen, I'll be honest. Production doesn't even tell me stuff. Other people had to text me and go, hey, I think we're getting shut down. I haven't heard that. Then I'd get a call and go, how did they know? How did people on Twitter know before the host of the show? No, I think, and here's the other thing. I used to be a doctor, and so I have a lot of friends. If you watch ABC, their chief medical correspondent, Jen Garfine, still our Jen Ashton, lifelong friend. We went to med school together, and she's really on the front lines. And you know, the thing that they say is, we don't know. We just don't know. We're still gathering information. We're trying to figure out when things will get back to a semblance of normal. The biggest thing is, when can we stop the social distancing? Because virtually there are very few productions that can go on. And, you know, obviously entertainment not being the right actual landmark for the recovery, but just for the purposes of this, you know, with Ninja Warrior, we have hundreds of athletes and thousands of fans together. So, you know, we can't in good conscience get that going until we get the all clear. And so, you know, nobody knows. But the reality is, I think everyone, you know, in LA, they started the quarantine in place pretty early. And so, God, I mean, it's been 3 or 4 weeks of, you know, sitting at home, an occasional trip to the supermarket. But other than that, going a little stir crazy. But you know, I will say this, there's always a silver lining. For me, I'd been on the road nonstop for pretty long. But for the past 7 months, I was doing a show, Live Rescue, out of New York for A&E, where I was in New York.
I want to know, how does that show work? So it's an A&E network. It's called Live Rescue. And is it like Cops kind of?
Well, if you know Live PD, which is, it's Cops, but it's live. It's Live PD, which is a monster show. And so they do Friday and Saturday. So we were Monday. So I would fly to New York. The hub of the show is the A&E studios out of New York, 45th and 2nd. And so I'd go in there. We have crews that are riding in 7 cities with paramedics, firefighters, first responders. So Monday night, I'd be in studio. And, you know, if you watch Sunday Ticket ever in the NFL, it's kind of like that. Where I'm in the studio, I'm like, hey, let's go to the Green Bay game. I'm like, let's go out to Tallahassee. We've got a fire. Sacramento, there are gunshots. And so we'd be going. And, you know, we had a show. So our last, we were doing a show March 16th. The one before on the 9th, I remember we had people, they were responding to somebody who had a fever. And so, of course, at that point, we were aware of coronavirus.
Was it the 9th of February?
No, this was March. So this was still, it was going, but at the same point, just to show how quickly this was changing, we still had the crews out there. And of course, the first responders still have to go, but they were going to an infection and we were raising the specter of coronavirus. And they were like, you know what? We don't want to bring it up because we don't want to start a panic. We don't know how widespread it is. So let's, until we have it confirmed, don't mention it.
Right.
Cut to the next week, the show, we could not go live because we had too many people. It just was unsafe for production to happen. And obviously the first responders are still going out. So, you know, that show's on hiatus. Live PD is doing a much more limited run right now, but a lot of it is going to be clip-based, or they may have me jump on just talking about my experience with first responders. So people are trying to figure out ways to do things safely. But it's hard. This is a time where, you know, Tiger King is, it is the show that hit at the perfect time. And I think when we look back on this, Tiger King is going to be indelibly linked to this moment, to this entire quarantine.
I agree with that.
And it's just been, you know, an interesting documentary that hit at the absolute right time when all now, of America.
Have you watched the whole thing?
I haven't even watched it. I've been busy watching Ozark. I just finished, and Jason Bateman is so good.
I love Jason Bateman.
Oh,
I have not seen the whole thing, so don't tell me. But no. I'm like 3 or 4 episodes in.
It is. It's one of those shows like Breaking Bad where you watch from the comfort of your bed, going, "Oh my God, I'm so glad I'm not in that situation."
Right.
So I think it's kind of good in the quarantine to watch.
And who's your favorite character on Ozark? Who do you? I mean, everyone.
Now, here's the thing: I was realizing I was watching, going, "I hate all of them," and yet. All of them are still, they have some redeeming character qualities where you see, no matter how despicable they seem, they humanize them. They're parents or, you know, they fall in love and you see these moments of humanity from them that I think the show does really well, where there's nobody who's a hero and nobody who's an absolute villain. They all are kind of shades of gray, which I think is, you know, a really interesting and kind of unusual take when you're like, who am I rooting for here?
Right.
Because you kind of find yourself, the family, they're really despicable, the things they're doing, but they're doing it to survive.
I will tell you this. Every time Ruth is on the screen, I laugh. Every time.
Yeah.
Every comment, she makes me laugh. And I know I probably shouldn't, but she's a funny person.
And it's amazing, though, how they, you know, and then they show this tough exterior, this brash exterior. And then you see the vulnerability of them, too. And they show people kind of going through and the pressure. All of this takes the toll it takes. And, you know, I think it is kind of apropos of we're all on lockdown right now. And the reality is, hey, it's LA. I'm okay in my house. I've got food, but you just see like the pressure's mounting. And I think of people in New York, you know, you got a family of 5, you're in a small apartment. Mm-hmm. The weather might not be great. You can't really take the elevator up. You're on top of each other.
Right.
And I just think people gotta be going nuts, which is why we need comedy.
That's exactly right. Have you heard from your buddy Schwarzenegger?
The governor, he has been killing it online. We were doing an event. Arnold, he has the Arnold Sports Festivals. It's become a worldwide thing. So Columbus is the biggest event, and I MC the Strongman, and so which is along with the Pro Bodybuilder. Those are the two tentpole events. So. I'm flying out there to host this thing. On Tuesday, the governor and the mayor of Columbus and the governor of Ohio come out and say, hey, we're going to ban the crowds. No crowds for this thing. And they blindsided Schwarzenegger. They didn't call him.
Now, he's Ohio, like, you know what? Was one of the first states to do that, right?
Yeah. So they banned the crowds and they're like, great, we'll ban the crowds. We'll do the event. I mean, this is, to give you an idea, this is, I think it's it's something like 80 sports, 21,000 athletes, 250,000 fans over 3 days. And people are coming from around the world. So they take these precautions, shut down the audience. They'll say, we'll do the events. And we arrive. And then it goes back up because they were still having Cavaliers games go off and Columbus Blue Jackets games going off. So the sports festival is like, well, it seems you're allowing some crowds. What can we do? So it was this real time back and forth. And we go to this event, ended up not being many crowds other than the final night. And so, we have the Strongmen who I did it last year. We'd have 15, 20,000 people watching. And now we have like 100, some of their friends and family. And so I was with him as this was unfolding. And that was, you know, our first real taste of, hey, we're needed to take these measures and take it a little more seriously. And you know, as far as I know, there wasn't any active cases of COVID and we didn't hear any great spread. And so you don't know. You don't know. In hindsight, of course, it needed to be shut down. But, you know, that was just an example of how we're all learning in real time. And I think there was an idea of what we needed to do, but people just couldn't really grasp the severity of this. And we're still not totally sure. So I think we're all kind of taking these, you know, stay at home measures and trying to do the best we can and just hoping for the numbers to get better.
But you're in medical school. So do you look at it, do you think differently than most people look
you know,
at it?
I'm smart enough to know it's been a long time since I've been in medical school, but my dad's an infectious disease specialist. I have a lot of friends who are begging it. And, you know, like I said, Dr. Jen Ashton, these people are on the front lines and I talked to them and they have a good idea, but they're the first ones to say, we just don't have enough data. So let's err on the side of caution. as we figure out how transmissible it is, what the real morbidity and mortality is with this. So it's amazing to watch this unfolding in real time. And everyone's, you know, taking their best guesses and trying to do things that are smart and still balance the need for the world to go on. I mean, you're a small business owner that relies on people being there. And so, you know, to think of all these businesses that are just sitting here going, hey, we want to be well, but at the same time, we got to, what are we going to do to get money?
Can I tell you, man, right now, and I believe me, I'm not the only one. Everyone is in a brutal situation right now, but with the stimulus programs and the SBA programs that are out there and the unemployment, and it's the $2 trillion to work my way through all of that is, I mean, right now things are tough enough, right? For everyone. It's a whole unknown that we all have. So then you hear about the $2 trillion. You're going, okay, maybe I'll get a little taste of that. That's all right. You know what? It's my turn to get rescued. And can I tell you, it's brutal. I don't think of that. I don't know who's going to get it, but I don't think daddy's getting any of it. And it's like, come on. Cause we got, Matt, we got shut down. We had a show, and I can tell you the moment that I knew, this is trouble.
Yeah.
Is that we had, at the time, we had a show going at Wise Guys. It was on a Wednesday night. And everyone is before the show started. And we had the TV on like we always do.
Right.
And Utah Jazz playing the game at Oklahoma
City.
And that was the game when they pulled everyone off. They were getting ready to start the game.
Yeah.
And they pulled everyone off the court. And then a little while later, they go, oh, by the way, Rudy Gobert has coronavirus.
Yeah.
Gosh. And I felt at that moment, because a lot of the club at this on a Wednesday night, which is rare, that it was packed. It was truly packed that night. And the show hadn't started. So on the big screen, they see this weird occurrence of a game going to be starting, but it's not. And then the refs leave. And then suddenly Rudy Gobert has tested positive. And that's when it was like, oh, this is in, at least here in Utah.
Yeah.
That's when it became more real for me. And I think for a lot of people that became the moment of truth for us. And then from that moment on, business kerplunk, bloody nose done. And now it's just like, what are we going to do? So I figured, hey, you know what? I have a laptop and I have a friend named Matt Eisman. So we'll do that. Maybe that'll help.
Well, yeah, and here's the thing. I think when this is all done, people are going to be so hungry for community, for comedy, for laughter, for normalcy. It's just when, you know, because I know all the comics want to get there and all the people want to get there, and figuring out when it's safe. And it's, to me, I think one of the toughest things is just this indefinite nature of it, where we're all sitting here going, tomorrow, next week, next month, when will we have some idea of what's going on? Because I think if they just said, listen, till August, it's going to suck, but then we'll be back and it'll be fine. It'd be like, all right, let's gird it. But it's, you know, it's mid-April, late April, June, where we're kind of, you know, just trying to figure it out. And I think it's really challenging because initially there's this, hey, we're all locked down. We're in this together. Isn't it great being home and getting to those projects? And then you're like, listen, I was talking to my brother. I was like, man, I'm feeling a little stir crazy. He goes, I have a wife, I have a job, and I have a 7-year-old that are all around me all the time. Enjoy your peace. Okay.
So Matt, are you truly by yourself in your place?
I'm solo. And so I'd had one buddy who I'm dragging out, just trying to, you know, we're keeping socially distant, but we're like going on rides together.
Good.
Just to have some contact. Because it ain't a great time to be dating.
Hey, so we're doing a Facebook Live and we're taking questions.
Yes.
And I'm trying to find if there's any questions.
I'm sure there are tons. There got to be. People are
asking questions. Someone wanted to know about my fern.
Is there just one, or is there another one? Are you between two ferns?
I'm going solo with a fern.
Right, one fern.
But it was just, otherwise it was just a regular
old blank wall. Yeah, you look like you're in prison. You're a hostage.
This is new. This is all new stuff. Someone says, hey, Matt, love seeing you. I love watching you on the Anthony Cumia show. I love Cumia. His impressions. best. When you're on, why haven't you called the show while in quarantine? It's like, you know, I don't know who asked this question, but I'll say this, because there's more loyalty to Keith Stubbs than there is to Anthony Cumia.
Oh, yeah.
But why haven't you called into Cumia?
Well, you know, I think Anthony's a very funny guy. You know, they're working for NBC and having been on Hallmark and some of these other channels. Oh, you know, there is.
Let me ask you this then. Okay, so let's get to it here for a second then. So what you're telling me, because I'm familiar with Anthony Cumia, makes me laugh. But they can go off the deep end from time to time and maybe go to areas maybe they shouldn't. And are you saying, Matt Eisman, that you have relations?
Wait, is this breaking up right here? I'm totally changing the subject. Did you see that official for the WHO who they asked him, will the WHO recognize Taiwan and the WHO is hugely funded by China? He goes, I didn't hear the question. She starts repeating. He goes, let's move on. Then he just hung up. I was like, so that's the way you handle a question that you don't want to answer.
Okay.
No, listen, there's a lot of comedy out there, but yeah, you know, you also want to be respectful of your audiences and your employers.
Okay. So being on with me, that wasn't.
Keith Stubbs, he's pound cake, man. He does the dry bar.
Oh, by the way, I'm going to show this hat. This hat here, I don't know if you guys realize, I've lost a little hair in the last. Yeah, I've got a little bit of a hair issue. But this is a Matt Eisman hat. And this was, I believe, this is first generation, Matt
Eisman. It's the only generation. I think I made 40 of them. And most of them are gone. You got one. My mom has one that she wears when horse riding. And that was inspired by the Michael Jordan Air Shadow silhouette logo. And I came up with that. And I'm wearing the Wise Guys logo. Very UW. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. We go into these flex fits. We appreciate a good hat game, Keith.
Flex fit, big noggin. Let me get another question for you. Someone says going from being a doctor to stand up doesn't seem common path. What possessed you to do this? do you ever look at it? Because I mean, you're in entertainment and you're killing it. From my perspective, it looks to me like, I know when you're in it, you may think, oh, it's not that good. Yeah. But I look at what you're doing, I'm going, man, this is insane. This is exciting. You're like the Seacrest of other stuff. You're like the Ryan Seacrest of muscle-y stuff.
It has been, a ridiculous ride out here, and certainly not the path I planned. And I don't know, you know, growing up, entertainment was never on my radar as something. You know, I grew up in Denver, and it was just, hey, you work hard, you go to college, you get a job, you go on with your life. Entertainment, just, it didn't seem feasible. I didn't know anyone in it. And I was in med school in New York, and I did stand up a couple times. And it wasn't until I was in residency. So I got my MD, I went back to Colorado. I was doing my training at the University of Colorado. And it was like, man, my heart is not in this. This is, because it's not a job, medicine. And now it's more evident than ever that what these people do is a calling. I mean, they're literally putting their lives on the line right now to care for other people. And it's an amazing job. And it was one of those things that you don't do it half-assed. You don't do it just as a paycheck. You do it because it's a calling. And I didn't feel it inside of me. And it was this horrible feeling. And so I struggled. I really struggled for like a year. And then I said, I guess I just got to take a year off and figure things out and clear my mind. So I thought, you know, you could be a ski bum. You could, you know, be a bartender, whatever, travel. And I thought, you know, I'd done stand up a couple of times and I'd never done anything creative. Mm-hmm. I thought this is the way to clear my brain. I'll move to LA, try stand up. And my thought was I'll grow up. I'll appreciate the career in medicine. I'll go back and get it out of my system. Instead, I just fell in love with being on stage and having a crowd. And you know, I was doing open mics in LA. This was not the Evening at the Improv. It was four other bitter comics barely listening. But there was just something about it that I just felt like this is what I was meant to do. And I think, you know, would it have been cheaper to not have done medicine and go straight into entertainment? Yeah, but the two things I learned were, I think medicine gave me a real determination. You know, it honed that ability to work hard and that ability to just grind. But the other thing it gave me was such a perspective on this business of, you know, this is not life and death. What those people are facing in hospitals right now, that's life and death. We're making shows about ninjas. We're doing entertainment. We're telling jokes. And at the end of the day, I will pour my heart into it, but I know nobody dies if I screw up. And it's just been so awesome to get to do this now for as long as I have, and to have had, you know, Ninja Warrior has been this unbelievable gift. We're going into season 12. We have a spinoff show, Ninja Junior, that's airing on Friday nights right now on Universal Kids. I'm doing live rescue and getting to stand up.
Are you hosting Ninja Kids too?
Yeah, Ninja Junior. It's our second season. It's ridiculous. This is our fourth. We did Team Ninja, Ninja versus Ninja, College Ninja Warrior. We've got Ninja Junior. You know,
are they going to go ninja old school? They're going to do that? Like,
well, the reality is, we've had 77-year-olds on the show.
I know, but I'm talking about 77-year-olds. Well,
like The Bachelor. The Bachelor is doing right. Golden Pond. I love what I do. I love stand up. I love being on stage. I love having a crowd, and it's so much fun getting to do these things that as a kid I would have thought this is the great. I never would have thought it's possible, and that's, you know, I'm looking Schwarzenegger. Like, to me, that's The Apprentice. This is the welcome card I got. I don't know if you can see it, but so Celebrity Apprentice, I got to do it with the new boss. It was when the old boss got his job, and so it was with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I was, you know, our show, the Apprentice became, you know, a political hot football, hot potato, whatever. It became a little toxic on TV.
Now it became toxic because people didn't. Was it still produced by Donald Trump?
He had nothing to do with it, but in name, he was a creator. So his name was on it. He chose to keep his name on it. So people who loved him were mad because he was no longer hosting. People who hated him were mad because he was still, his name was involved. So, you know, I end up winning the final shot of the season, me drinking champagne with executive producer Donald J. Trump under my name. And so it was, you know, and because I won, I thought, hey, this is going to introduce me to a whole new audience. Instead, not a lot of people saw it. And I was complaining about it one time. And my buddy, my best friend, since we were like three growing up, goes, dude, are you kidding? You won. You're friends with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Growing up. Like, you had his poster on your wall, and now you get to travel with him. He took me to Europe to do an event with him. It was on my birthday, and he's singing happy birthday to me. And I'm like, this has been the thing where I'm like, if it all went away, if everything went away and I had to go back to whatever, delivering pizzas or something, I'd still be like, I got to become friends with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's all worth it for that alone. And every time I'm with him, it's just such a kick. There is a guy who is larger than life. And when you're around him, it's like you're in business school. Just seeing the charisma and the passion and the way this guy can talk to, you know, people who are the janitors to heads of state, and they all are groveling like little fanboys like me when they're around him. It's awesome.
Have you met his wife?
Well, he's divorced. I have not met Maria. He's dating Maria Shriver. I've never met Maria, which she spent a lot of time at Hallmark where I was doing a morning show, but never met Maria, but have met the kids, who are, and they're all awesome kids, like really,
that's
really well-grounded, kind of, you know, into their own stuff. And I think, you know, despite, some transgressions that have been well-publicized, I think he and Maria have been good parents together. And it's still amazing seeing how this guy's 72. He just had a heart procedure again, and he's just still, you know, still a movie star, still doing these sporting events, still politically active, still lobbying for so many charities, traveling the world. And it's just, when you're around him, you get revved up. You're like, oh man, what more can I do? Then he leaves and I go take a nap or play video games.
All right, let me get you some more questions here.
Yes.
Someone wants to know if I'm talking into a hairdryer. So no, that's not a hairdryer. This is called a...
The Blue.
Yeah, the Blue. Those are like, okay, aren't they?
Yeah, they're great.
I don't even know where the camera is. They're all right. But if it looks like a hairdryer, trust me, I don't use a hairdryer. It's not really necessary.
It looks like a modern day Frank Sinatra crooning microphone.
That's what it looks like.
I got you, babe.
Oh, man. Matt Eisman, so you're going to go back on the road?
Yeah, I hope. You know, I mean, I had dates planned, and you know, we're trying to find a date to get out there. And as soon as this is done, it's going to be crazy because I think every comedian is just, they're just going to want to be on stage and the crowd's going to want to see him. So yeah, it'll be great to be back out. It'll be great to be working again.
You know, it's weird is I still hear from the agents and the agents are working from their homes and they,
yeah,
you know, everyone's taken a hit on this as much as I want to rip into some of the agents who, you know,
yeah,
that I know, but, but it's really difficult for everyone. There's so much uncertainty. And then a lot of the really the big time, big name comics that are selling out theaters and not just theaters, but like arenas, they're looking to come back into the clubs for a while before they go back out. So there's a possibility that that happens.
And you'll know, right. And I heard someone talk about that where they're all just, it's just going to kick down, you know, then everyone else, it'll just shuffle down. But the, you know, those comics who really probably are the most hand to mouth, like, sorry, you know, if Kevin Hart wants to come do a warm-up set for our warm-up weekend here, we're booking Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
And well, it, you know, it's one of the, it's the business. It is the business where, you know, it's one of those things where it's just, you know, you never try to take it personally and you just try to get to be one of the people who people want.
Okay. Here's a question from Adam Johnson for Matt Eisman. Do you think when all this crap is over, COVID, and things go back to normal, that people will stop being so sensitive when it comes to comedy? You think this is going to change people?
I don't know. I hope so. I hope so. But I don't know. I mean, I think we've definitely seen people prioritizing things during this where, you know, the idea of finding fault with people over small things. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's been an interesting time for comedy. Comedy has certainly been evolving lately and how this will change it. I don't know. I think, you know, I'm, as we were talking about some of the people we spoke of earlier, I'm a big proponent of all types of comedy being allowed. If you don't like it, don't tune in.
I'm with
but
that.
But it should be allowed to exist. And I think the comedy can do an important job of making people laugh about things that are otherwise difficult to talk about or just, you know, raising a different perspective on things. So,
but you know you're looking in our lifetime, I'm a little older than you, but in our lifetime, if you look back at some of the occurrences over the last 20, 30 years, particularly 9/11, I do remember after 9/11, I remember when I first found out what was happening, it was in the comedy world. It was like comedy will not survive. People are not ever going to laugh right. again. Remember that? It was like no one's going to laugh again. And then it worked itself out. It takes a little time, and the comedians have to figure out how to approach subjects that are extraordinarily sensitive and unique.
Yeah.
But do you remember that? Do you remember the feeling of that? That was like,
I think it was funny. Was it Joan Rivers or Gilbert Gottfried? I think, was that when he did The Aristocrats, Gilbert? It was right around then. And Joan Rivers, I think they were the two of the first comedians who were like, this is when we need comedy. And I do think there is some of that of, you know, people, when people feel comedy is dead or it's something's too serious for it. I think that's when comedy is really helpful for so many people just to be like, God, let's crack this shell, man. Let's, because you got some emotions in there. Let's laugh to get them out. Otherwise, you're going to cry. And it's, you know, it's, I think it's I've always thought humor is the best way to deal with serious emotions, the best way to just kind of confront it and get it out there and try to handle it. So, you know, I think comedy is going to be more needed than ever. It's just a question of how will people consume it? You know, if it's in clubs or if it's going to be, you know, when people will get over this, because I think there is going to be, people are going to be so pent up.
Yeah.
They're just going to want to be around other people and laughing and have some sense of normalcy.
I agree with that. I think that it'll take a little while for people to acclimate like they did with 9/11. Cause I was open. Wise Guys had barely opened. Then 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And it was like,
well, oh, I mean, the laugh off was in August. It was right before it. I don't know. It's such a good question as to how will this impact the state of comedy. I don't know. I mean, look, comedy's changing, but people are always going to want to laugh. So it's, you know, figuring out, I guess, you know, what the new rules are. I
do remember when 9/11 happened and a few other things. I mean, when the stock market took the big dump in 2008, I do remember going, oh, I guess I'm going out of business. This is what going out of business feels like.
Yeah.
Because it was like business went to zero. all that happened. It's like, yeah. Oh, okay. So I guess it's over. Is that how this is going to go down? And you know, right now it feels, it feels similar to that in a way because, and it believe not just for me, but for everyone, everyone's life, everyone's gig, everyone's relate, everything's thrown off, everyone's job. Even if you get a salary from somewhere, what you're doing is affecting someone else. And it is tough, tough situation. So I spend all my time watching CNN and get mad. And then,
oh God, I have to log off social media.
It really is
one of those things when you're like, let me get some pertinent information. Let me put it down. Cause you can sit there for hours going, oh my God, the sky is falling. We're all going to die. What's the point of any of this?
That's what I do. That's exactly me. Describe me. I'm that guy.
I do think this is unprecedented in its scope and the worldwide impact of this, but you're right. I think there is an advantage as you get older and having lived through things that felt like the world was ending where you realize life goes on. You know, it may change, there may be some impact, but eventually people want normalcy and they'll adapt to whatever will become the new normal, but they're still going to want to laugh, still going to want to eat, want to get drunk, want to have sex, they want to do all that stuff. And it's just a question of when can they do it?
You know, with 9/11, one of the main differences is that, you know, the World Trade Center was attacked and that was a weird, what's going to happen next thing. Now with the COVID, everyone in the world, so it's not like, oh, there's a good guy and a bad guy.
Right.
Like with anytime there's a terrorist attack or a war. Right. And you side with whoever you want. But this is everybody. So everyone, if they're in Ecuador or if they're in Brazil or if they're in Russia, everyone is under the same threat, which is frightening. I hope it brings people together. I don't know.
I think there is, you know, I do think it is. I just think if you watch the news or social media, that's where you see people hashing things out.
Right.
In probably I think it's just the, you know, a small segment of what's really going on that can, you know, when you go around your community, you see people coming together and neighbors helping neighbors. I don't know. I think this is the we are the world moment. And it will be interesting because viruses are a part of life. Like we expect the seasonal flu, and the question will be what's going to happen with, you know, COVID. If we knock it down now, will it come back in the winter? Will we always now every kind of winter, spring start to fear, oh my God, is there something else coming?
Yeah.
You know, where it's going to be a while where, and you know, I didn't grow up with it, but my mom told me about polio and how, you know, every summer, some kid would get it and they would be terrified to go swimming. And it just felt so scary. And then a vaccine came about and that's something we've never had to live with. And, you know, they're working at incredible speed to get a vaccine out, but it probably wouldn't be until, you know, next year at the earliest and barring some miracle. But, you know, this is also a chance, I think, for an unbelievable period of human ingenuity and kind of to see people responding under incredible circumstances. I think this is the first time, you know, certainly since I've been alive, where the entire world is uniting against one problem.
I agree with that.
And to see everyone, like, you know, this is not, hey, hunger or climate change where we're doing it in addition to things, where everyone is like, this is our focus right now, beating this virus. And it's, you know, amazing to see the companies developing masks and people figuring out these tests and working on vaccines and coming up with new ways to make masks. So it's awesome. It's an awesome chance to see people rising to the occasion. And again, one of the interesting things that I saw the president say this the other day when someone was saying, "Hey, are you downplaying this?" And the thing I liked that he said was, "This is awful. I could say a whole bunch of horrible things, but I want to deal in hope right now. I want to give people hope." And I thought that's not a bad thing. I keep thinking back to Morgan Freeman. Hope is a wonderful thing. I hope I see my friend. I hope. And I think it's nice to say, man, I'm trying to focus on the positive stuff because, you know, when you watch that negative stuff or in the middle of the night when you know, your window's open, you wonder, is COVID sneaking in?
Well, you know what?
It can be scary. Matt,
just the other day when the Prez said, hey, we're going to have this thing done by Easter. Yeah. Well, no one believed it, but I was glad to hear something. And yeah. I was glad to hear that there's some kind of a, because you were talking earlier, we don't know when it's going to end, but
yeah.
The fact that he said Easter's great. Easter's a great holiday. The dude, he doesn't.
Fauci came out and like, obviously he's been the voice of reason in this. Yeah. And he's like, no, he's aspirational. That's what we're going for.
We need some aspiration.
Yeah. And he's like, that's our goal. And we didn't meet it. We ain't coming close to it, but I think hopefully just about everybody appreciates the severity of the situation. So, you know, let's have some comedy, man.
You want another question?
Yeah, I want another question.
This is from Dylan. He said, share some of your memories with Keith. That would be me with the hairdryer. Of the 2002 Olympics. The 2002 Winter Olympics were in Salt Lake City, for those of you who don't know. And we had the opportunity to perform. There were only a few comedians that were asked to perform in the Winter Olympics.
I think it was eight.
Is that what it was? Eight. And Matt Eisman was one. I was one. There was a few others.
When you told us about that opportunity, I remember getting giddy. Because the Olympics are huge. They really are. They're special. And it was so awesome. We got to go out there and we got to go into the Olympic Village. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing because to me, that was also, it was a big event because it was just after 9/11. Yeah. And they were talking about canceling the Olympics in Salt Lake. It made me fall in love with Salt Lake City to see how this city, how you guys had prepared for it and how it was so easy to get around, to get to the events. But we went into the Village and we performed and it was amazing, other than the fact that half the crowd didn't speak any English. I remember there were two brothers who grew up in Houston but had like an Argentinian parent who were part of the Argentinian bobsled team who were pretty much Cool Runnings it. And they were just drunk, having a blast. And it was so awesome. And we got a coin. I've actually got my coin over there that we got these coins, these like metal coins as a thank you, kind of a challenge coin if you're familiar with military. That was one of my most prized possessions. And I was just talking to PJ the other day, and we had photos in front of like the Olympic flame and watching the medals. It was just awesome. And so this was one of the reasons, you know, this in the grand scheme, not a big deal, but I was invited to cover the Olympics for NBC. I was going to be doing a daily show with Akbar on their streaming service, and we were going to get to go to Tokyo.
Oh, just here in a few months.
Here in a few months. They just invited us, and it was, you know, I was just like, man, this is going to be amazing. They're like, you know, we want you guys to have all the athletes. You'll get to go to any event you want. Any celebs we'll bring by. We want your show to be a ton of fun. I'm like, this is going to be a dream. This is going to be 2002, only even bigger. And, you know, it got pushed. And it'll, you know, it sounds like the Olympics will happen in 2021. And obviously, there are much bigger things to cry about. But it just, there are certain things, like getting to meet Schwarzenegger. There's certain things where you think, man, if I got to participate in the Olympics doing the broadcasting, hosting, it's just amazing some of the opportunities that come around. And 2002, again, probably well before I was ready, that you got us in there. And it was just PJ and I were just talking about how awesome it was to be a part of something. Because, you know, the Olympics, it's for these athletes, it's their biggest day of their lives. Mm-hmm. Something they've spent most of their lives training for. And for these people to be, you know, to be around these people who are all like hitting the peak of their lives at that moment. Right. And just imagining all the sex and partying that was going on that we weren't invited into.
His name is Matt Eisman. He's a man about town. He hosts like almost every other show that Sechrist doesn't host.
He gets sick, I'm willing to step in, Ryan.
Dude, I say why not? Well, they got that other dude trying to inch in on his territory on American Idol, that Bobby Bones. You see that?
Oh, no.
You know Bobby Bones?
Really? Uh-uh. Who is he?
He's a radio guy in Nashville, does country radio, but somehow, no one cares, by the way. I'm going to tell you this, though. But he's on American Idol, so Sechrist interviews some of these guys, and then this guy looks just like him. So I wonder if they're grooming this guy to replace
him. Could be. Maybe Sechrist is slowing down. He's got his half a billion dollars in the bank. He's just like, what do I got to hose for?
Here's another question for you. Are you going to be involved in the Patrice O'Neill documentary?
I'd met Patrice a couple times. I didn't know him that well. I doubt they'd invite me, but I will certainly watch it. I think he was an absolute beast. And when you mentioned that previous radio host, I remember back in the old days listening to Patrice, Bill Burr, Bobby Kelly, Rich Voss, Jim Norton, those guys going back and forth. Mm-hmm. And as a comedian, hearing those guys, just, you know, it's like tough crowd with Colin Quinn, where you just saw, man, those, you know, I thought they gave a glimpse of why comedy's so much fun for comedians, because you're around these other great, rapid, super fast minds. And it's so much fun when you're a comedian around other comics, just how you feel your mind. That's one of the things that I just, when I talk about why I love comedy, when you're on stage, you have to be so present, where it doesn't matter if you're sick, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, you just got dumped by a girl, or mm-hmm. you know, you're not feeling well, you're hungry, whatever. Once you get on stage, it all goes away and you're just there with the crowd. And to me, my mind never feels sharper than it does like midway through a set, when you're going, you're in a groove and you're feeling your jokes and you're looking at the room and you see someone who's not paying attention, like, oh, I'm going to comment on them and then call this back. And it just feels, you're so present. I always liken it to how Michael Jordan described the basketball, the hoop getting bigger and bigger when he just was on fire in the zone. And right. I think for comedians, that's the best feeling, to have your mind where you're on that high wire without a net and you're out there and you're making people laugh and you just feel like I got them in the palm of my hands and they don't even know what I'm about to hit them with. And that's why I thought Patrice was one of those guys who could just be in a room and just decimate people. But then when someone would get him, he'd laugh. And I think he was a great, fearless comedian. And, you know, there are often times where you think, man, I'd love to hear his take on how comedy is changing or some of these topics. And
yeah. Patrice O'Neill, he was at Wise Guys about 5 months before he passed away. And he was fantastic. Funny as can be. And you know what? He was nice, because I thought that he would be intimidating.
Yeah.
Kind of like, because he's a big guy and a great comic. So the point where you might be a little afraid of him.
Yeah.
He was nice. He was he was pleasant. And I had heard otherwise, right?
Yeah.
But no, he was fantastic. Let me get you another question. You want another one?
Yeah, I love this.
I know you got to go. What do you have to do tonight? What are you doing? You going to watch? Are you watching any of the late night stuff where they sit there and they do their show like we're doing right now?
I haven't been.
Yeah.
Is any of it worth it?
Yeah. There's moments when it's worth it. It's just different.
You know who I was watching? David Spade, he had that Lights Out, and he's been doing a monologue just on Twitter.
Yeah.
And Spade makes me laugh. The guy makes me laugh. He can be just that bitter, biting comedy, kind of like Jason Bateman. But man, few people do it as well as he does.
Have you been on that show, Lights Out with David Spade?
I haven't, man. I'd love to do it. It's tough. You know, I'm a comedian, but unfortunately out here, most of the people know I'm the really loud guy from Ninja Warrior. So got to remind these people.
Do you hang out at any of the comedy clubs when you're
sometimes down? I've been going to the Store and the Improv, but I was the travel to New York every week. You know, I'd fly out Sunday, fly back Tuesday, and then in between we were doing Ninja and corporate gigs. I just wasn't around in town enough, and now you can't. So
let me ask you this: do you turn gigs down? I mean, are there other things that you've been offered? You go, no, I'm not doing that.
The only things I've really turned down have usually been just time, because I still am a big proponent of saying yes to a lot of things and trying to. Yeah, I have a new podcast game show that's coming out April 14th called.
Tell me about that. I saw that. It's a game. It's a podcast game show.
Yeah.
Which is perfect for the what's going on. Was this worked on prior to all
this? We did this back in October. We did 50 episodes, and it's with Endeavor Audio, who does. They did like the Dick Wolf did a serial thing with Parker Posey. They had one with Rami Malek.
Right.
And they're kind of trying to change the podcast model. I think has been just really content focused, and they're trying to do high quality content, but also figure out ways to monetize it better and advertise better. And so having William Morris Endeavor in there is a little bit better, you know, neither here nor there for me, but we did a game show. The people who created it, Cleve Keller and Dave Knoll, they created Chop. They created Punchline. They created thousands of hours of TV, and they're really good at shows. So it's a trivia show. Three people play. The hook is we give you a clue that's the initials of the answer. So, you know, it would be HP. Okay. HP was an orphan who grew up with his aunt and uncle. He was forced to live under the stairwell. HP went to an unusual school for special children. HP was considered an expert at what he does.
Harry Potter?
Yes, there it is. So,
did I win anything?
The hook is, okay, so when you think, you only get one guess. So you got to figure out, you know, with the other people going, it's fun.
So do you keep giving the trivia questions?
Yeah. And so the hints keep getting more obvious until like he had glasses and a lightning scar on his forehead. Right. And so, you know, we go through, we play three rounds and then the winner goes to a bonus round, and it's just mindless trivia. You can play it in the car. And the cool thing is it's not Jeopardy, where you have to have this vast encyclopedic knowledge. Like most of the stuff you can figure out, it's just a question of how quickly you figure it out. So, you know,
so there hopefully. Are contestants. Are they
so
just random?
We did it. Yeah, we did it. We did it at a sound studio in New York. We'd have three contestants,
right.
But we ran it like a game show. We ran it with, you know, sound effects. We had music coming in and out. So it's, if you think about it, a lot of times Jeopardy's on, you're not even watching, you're listening.
Right.
And you don't need any visual elements. So that's what this show is. But because they designed it as a regular game show, they actually sold it to NBC. So we were planning to shoot a pilot. Actually, this weekend, I was supposed to be in Connecticut shooting the pilot for this for TV. But that's on hold. So.
Would this be, if it had all worked out, was the idea to be a summer game show?
Or? So it could be primetime. What they were looking to do is a daytime syndicated show. So kind of like Wheel or Jeopardy or something where it'd be on, you know, different markets, different channels, but it would be probably on 5 days a week. That would be the ultimate goal.
Are the guests celebrities or the contestants?
So we did, you know, for the podcast we did, they were just people in New York, most of whom were in entertainment because they're the people who signed up.
Right.
And so next Tuesday, we're actually to raise awareness, but also to raise money for Feed America. We're going to do a celebrity version. So it's going to be like the Bella Twins and Ross Matthews. You know, they'll play like a bonus round. And
I should know who the Bella Twins are.
Oh, they're Nikki and Brie Bella. They're WWE Hall of Famers, and they have the Bellas show.
I should know that. Well, oh, the Bella Twins. I know. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Yeah.
That's great. And then Ross Matthews, you mean
Ross? Ross! Hello, yeah. Ross. We did a morning show together, Hollywood Today Live. That kid, he is funny and quick-witted, but he is so competitive. He plays trivia out in Palm Springs every Sunday and rarely loses. Ross is he's a bulldog.
Like he goes out to these bars.
He has a summer house. Yeah, but he does like a brunch one with champagne because Ross is fabulous. He is awesome. I love that guy dearly. I think has he done Wise Guys?
No. Is he touring? I saw that he's doing.
He has a book out, so he was doing, but I think he wasn't doing, I don't know if he was doing clubs, theaters, and he does a lot of, he's in RuPaul's world, he's a judge on Drag Race. Right. So he does lots of things with the drag queens, and we actually did something together that hasn't been announced yet, so
we'll okay.
kind of tease it there.
Is it, let me ask you this, have you been on the, that mask show? What is that?
Oh, the mask. No, I've got a terrible voice. I'd be perfect for that show. I would love to go on it.
So I was watching like 5 minutes of it last night, or maybe a little more than that, because you watch everything now that you're.
Yeah.
So what is it? Are these people, is it actually their voices? Is that who's singing?
It's their voices. They modulate them when they're talking to kind of conceal it in case they have a really recognizable voice.
Right.
And you know, it when this show came out, we're kind of in the business, so we, you know, you hear about some of the shows, and every network passed on it, and Fox was like, fine, we'll take a flyer on this. Nobody thought it was going to be anything. It turned out not just to be the biggest reality show, it was the biggest show of the year that came out, and it has been this unexpected hit. And you know, Dr. Ken is on it, and he brings on Joel McHale a ton.
What a good guy he is. Ken is a great guy.
He is a wonderful guy, and he's doing the UK version. He and Joel have a podcast out. And I mean, Dr. Ken is who I aspire to be as a doctor turned comedian when I grow up.
Didn't he go to Duke?
He went to Duke. Yeah. Oh yeah. And clearly he's doing very, very well.
All right. His name is Matt Eisman. He's a thrill a minute. He's got it going on. He's killing it. There was one other question. So the Masked Singer, have they asked you to do it?
No. So
how do you get that? Is that an agent tough thing? Does the agent go to the TV
a little
show
bit, but it's because it's on Fox, NBC would probably be a little bit, yeah, hesitant Dan about having me go on there because we talked about Dancing with the Stars. I haven't been invited. I was invited to do Celebrity Big Brother on CBS. I'm a big fan of the show, and my friend's a co-EP on the show, and they knew I was a fan, and they invited me. And NBC was saying, and I'm like, don't worry, I do not want to go on that show.
Now, that's a CBS show?
That's a CBS show, but that's one where you're locked in a house. You know, it's like 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Isn't that kind of a naughty show? Can it go that way?
It can. And that, you know, so same with Apprentice. And that was one of the concerns is in Apprentice, you know, we were on camera from 7 a.m. till 9 p.m., 6 days a week for 5.5 weeks. And before I went on, you know, and NBC invited me, and I knew, look, they know I got invited because I was on Ninja. And so you think they'll be a little bit protective, but ultimately they have a show to make. And so my bosses at Ninja, the last thing they said was, when you go on the show, remember, people like you. And so, because, you know, it is. The reality is people get under your nerves. They get under your skin. And, you know, I was lucky that I was kind of under the radar. So I was kind of the goofy, nice guy who was the least famous. So I don't think anyone was threatened by me. So I avoided it. But with Big Brother, I'd be scared. You'd be scared that you say one wrong thing and not only do you lose, your career is over.
Yeah. So and that's the same way with being on some of these other shows.
Yeah.
Might be a little over the top.
I mean, I did go on Lip Sync Battle and Dress as Cher. So with my parents in the audience. So clearly I
how did you do on that?
Hold on.
You won? Okay. What do we got?
I didn't get my coin, but I will get this. My lip sync. Look at this. Come on now.
Does it fit? Do you wear it ever?
This thing is like 20 pounds.
So it'll fit. Did you wear this in like in one episode? You were able to get this belt?
Yeah, one episode. I beat Akbar. Wasn't even close. He went into Mike Tyson in his prime, Keith. That guy had no business being on the stage with a performer like myself. It was so much. You know, in that show, God, they called on a Friday. We taped on a Sunday. I showed up Sunday morning, and we taped it too. Rehearsed for like 3 hours to do two songs. You know, and I'm in drag. We're doing full choreography. I'm in high heels and a thong. It wasn't pretty, but you know, I love performing. I love an audience, and I like going all in. So I don't mind looking like a jackass, a sexy jackass.
Did you get to pick the songs?
Yeah, they give you a list of like 60 songs because everything has to be cleared.
Right.
So I did Meatloaf. I Would Do Anything for Love, which is
a good one.
Absolutely love. And then Cher, I did Believe. But I did in her Turn Back Time outfit, which was the one she was on the battleship.
Did they auto-tune you?
No. Well, we lip-synced. So, okay. But it was, God, they should have auto-tuned me because I still, I thought I'll be a decent looking woman. I look like Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. I looked ugly. I was a big woman. Wasn't pretty, but it was fun.
Matt, I'm going to let you go. You need to go.
Pound cake. I got to say, man, thank you. This has been a blast. You're a good friend to me and to comedians everywhere.
We're going to have you out as soon as all this nonsense, whatever man, this is.
I will tell you, I will be there the first weekend if you'll have me, unless, you know, Kevin Hart shows up. I'll be out there anytime because I love your clubs. I love your fans.
Well, Matt, tell PJ Walsh I said, what's up?
Will do.
Very funny comedian. Tell him.
Will do.
Hello. Tell Schwarzenegger hello from me. And thanks again for being on this. And I wish you nothing but the best. You're going to get through it, and you're going to get four more shows to host.
Yeah, buddy.
You're going to get on The Mask, whatever it is. It's all going to work out great for you.
Well, I know the fans will be out there supporting Wise Guys as soon as you open the doors.
All right, man. Well, thanks for your friendship, and take care, buddy.
Likewise, Keith. Thanks, buddy.